Tom Woods Show, episode 2193.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking today about the myth of labor's declining share, that is, the allegedly declining amount of dough going to labor from the national income, or that labor is not being paid according to its productivity anymore, that there's been a divergence between labor productivity and what labor is compensated. And the result of all this is that you have all kinds of commentators wringing their hands about, well, I guess this is just what the market economy does, so you can see what follows from that. This has even fooled some libertarians, because it is actually a myth. And our old friend Gene Epstein is going to explain to us why this is actually a myth. People are just reading the data wrong. This is not actually happening. It's in people's imaginations. It's not real. And you know Gene Epstein by now, director of the Soho Forum, former economics editor at Barron's, also was a chief economist for the New York Stock Exchange. He has a long, long list of things he's done and accomplished in his life. But I am glad to say that right now, his chief thing he's going to be doing is talking to us right here on the Tom Woods Show. Welcome back, Gene. It hasn't been too long.
No, it has not been that long, Tom. And it's always a privilege and a pleasure to be on your show. And as we agreed, this time I'm not going to indulge in an excess of intros and off-the-cuff comments that hopefully the listeners don't mind my persisting in doing. But I just want to mention one interesting number, because we're going to be discussing numbers. Fascinatingly enough and coincidentally, on Monday, September 19th, 2016, we had the first Soho Forum in Soho. And on Monday, September 19th, 2022, to the day, we're going to have another Soho Forum. So it's going to be a perfect to the day, 6-year anniversary of the Soho Forum. That's just a fantastically coincidental fact. I hope everybody can come to our September 19th, 2020 celebration of our 6-year anniversary and take a look and see what it's going to be, a debate about nuclear weapons in New York City. And of course, listen to us on podcast, because you can actually listen to that September 19th, 2016 debate and all our debates since then on podcast. So I'm going to shut up from now on, Tom, and we can launch into the substance of our discussion today.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. I watched your presentation. I've heard you on this subject a little bit before.
I know. Yeah, we've discussed it a bit on the show here and there.
Yeah. On the subject of labor's share of, national income, however you want to think about it. It's quite, apart from this guy at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, yeah, you are really a lone voice on this, because even some libertarian economists have bought into this narrative that, it's a kind of a shame to see labor's not doing so well compared to how it was before.
It includes the Cato.
Right. But it turns out that, can it really be, Gene, that everybody's missing something? They're all looking at this wrong?
Yeah, Tom, it's looking upsetting that the emperor has no clothes and that I'm the little kid putting this out. Actually, on top of that, as I say, look, I have a guy. This assistant chief economist at the Bureau of Economic Analysis has written a paper on the subject, and he's declared in this paper, peer-reviewed paper, labor share is within its historical range. And so you would think that he knows what he's talking about. I was just a sloppy-ass journalist for many years, and I've got this Austrian stigma on me that I love Murray Rothbard, so who's going to believe me? But you'd think that the guy who's an assistant chief economist at the place that issues the numbers knows the numbers well. But between you and me, it seems like he wants to keep a low profile. He's got the paper out, but he doesn't want to contradict anybody. And I hope you recognize that I went through the textbook on this subject. You know, I quoted the definition of national income. I just basically harped on the simple facts of the matter by quoting from the handbook of the Bureau of Economic Analysis that, to my amazement, prestigious economists from mainstream universities are constantly claiming this point that labor share is in the toilet, as we'd like to say, they latch upon all kinds of crazy reasons for it, and none of them make any sense, because the punchline is that labor share, hopefully we're going to define what we mean by it, is actually a little higher than it was in the 1950s and 60s. In other words, it's a little higher than it was in the glory days for progressives, when unions were strong and when all these awful corporations weren't really around, that competition from abroad was minuscule, productivity was rising quickly. So all good things were happening, and yet labor share has actually recently been doing a little bit better than in those glory days. So all I can do is plead that I did spend 26 years covering the numbers, so I probably learned a little bit more about the numbers than they did. I spoke a lot to the people at these agencies to find out how the numbers work. So I can only plead with you, Tom, to say that I'm right and they're wrong.
Okay. By the way, I feel like if there could be a tagline of the Tom Woods Show, other than the thing about 3x5 cards, it would be, I'm right and they're wrong. You know, so you're in good company, Gene. That is kind of the way I look at things.
Well, thanks. Yeah, Tom, exactly. You know, you two are an outlier, so you're willing to listen to a guy like me. Thanks very much.
Yes. So let's start with, obviously, people can't see anything.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have you imagine in your mind a graph that's plotting, I guess, people's monetary compensation against productivity.
Yeah.
And these two things for a long time tracked each other.
Yeah.
But in this graph that is inflation adjusted, suddenly the productivity goes up while the compensation lags behind.
Yes.
And this is taken as a commonplace by everybody that, well, there's been this divergence. And of course, you can imagine Marxists having a field day with this.
Yeah.
But you looked a little bit more closely at this, and what did you find?
Yes. This is going to be a good session because it has, I have got the great explicator, the great communicator, Tom Woods, having listened to my lecture. By the way, the lecture was delivered, that you saw, Tom, was delivered at the Mises Institute in front of a great crowd of kids. And I recently was talking about how kids aren't interested in listening to lectures. But of course, this was a select group of really motivated young people who listened to a fantastic series of lectures from Mises, an Austrian economist, and they're willing to put up with me. And I threw up the charts. And you are one of those people who listened to the lecture as well, and you grasped it. So again, to recapitulate what you've just said, it shows that the typical chart that you see on Twitter, I delivered this lecture, by the way, at Porkfest, the Porcupine Fest in New Hampshire. And one of the guys in the audience said, yeah, look, I see this on Twitter all the time. What do you see on Twitter? You see that from the late 1940s through the early 1970s, about 1971, 72, labor compensation as defined, conventionally defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, labor compensation per hour, I should say, as they calculated, it tracked output per hour, productivity. Both series are inflation adjusted. And the fact that they are both inflation adjusted makes them seem sacrosanct. And then you find that these two inflation adjusted series, the labor productivity rises fairly steadily from the early 70s, and the compensation way lags it. So the exploitation rate becomes wider and wider and absolutely horrifying. Is one of the subtler jokes, Tom, as I also mentioned in the lecture, that there's a contingent of gold bugs, I guess, who look at the early 1970s and say, aha, what happened then? Well, President Nixon closed the gold window. You know, the gold window being that the U.S. was obligated to give you gold, give a foreigner gold, not a citizen, not an American citizen, but give a foreigner gold for any dollar that foreigner held. And this was running out of control, way too many dollars out there. So Nixon closed the gold window. And maybe it can be blamed on maybe the fact that he did that caused a lot of problems. But some of our semi-fanatical colleagues among the Austrians claim, well, that's the reason why labor productivity continued to increase and labor compensation lagged it severely. But it's odd, although they don't, I mean, I think they're almost religiously invested in this because they don't bother to explain exactly what the causal connection was. So I just try to point out that even, as you point out, even some of our fellow travelers believe in this chart. And my God, it comes directly from the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics. Who can doubt it? It's inflation adjusted. Well, I have shocked people. I've been shut off on Twitter because it looks as though I'm some kind of magician. By the way, I enjoyed that interview you had of Doc, what's his face?
Doc Dixon, yeah.
Doc Dixon, yeah. So I did a Doc Dixon. I took the same trends and I reran them and I showed that they actually track each other up to the present day, that they can be made to track each other. Nothing changed in the early 70s. From the early 70s through the present, through the second quarter of 2022, compensation is tracking productivity. And then I said dramatically, how did I do this? What was my conjuring trick? Well, I just took the price indexes out of it. I took the price indexes out of it and rendered them in what is known as nominal dollars. Then I point out, well, this isn't such an awful thing to do, right? It's not so unorthodox because, after all, labor is paid in nominal dollars. Business calculates its gains in nominal dollars. Business sells its goods in nominal dollars. It all happens in nominal dollars. And any mainstream economist will tell you, you line up a nominal with a nominal over a trend, and you get a real trend. You divide a nominal by a nominal, you get a real trend. That's another handy way of tracking the numbers. But then the real question is, why does the nominal dollar trend, which is perfectly valid, look so much different from the inflation-adjusted trend? It's because, as I put it wryly, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics was keeping two sets of books. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is deflating the compensation by the consumer price index, and it's deflating the output by the implicit price deflator, is what it's called. Now, then I showed through a chart that those two price indexes diverged just around the same time in the early 70s as the supposed trend in compensation versus output. So it's all in the price indexes. In other words, if you just take out the price indexes, make it real, make it valid in nominal dollars, and you find this is a complete myth. The one has not lagged the other at all. And then, of course, I hasten to add that I believe there's a problem with the CPI. And so I don't quite believe the inflation adjusted trends anyway. But I leave to say that's another argument altogether. If you want to say that something happened with respect to the consumer prices that labor faced and something else happened to the output that business was selling in terms of prices, you can do that. But if you want to make a point about how business is shafting labor, by the way, this is for the non-farm business sector. It's not government. It's strictly in the non-farm business sector, which is preferable for the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They don't like to deal with farms. It's a more valid measure. In the non-farm business sector, if you want to make the point that business is shafting labor, it simply doesn't hold up if you look at it straight in the eye in terms of nominal dollars. And so now there too, I have a source, I didn't mention him by name, but a source who was actually very high up at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and then went over to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And he's told me privately, yeah, this is a bit of a joke. Everybody believes in it. And as he put it, Riley, my source, I don't want to mention his name because I don't know if he wants me parading his reputation. Again, I, as a columnist at the Barron's, I got to know these people. Many of them are pretty bright. And he commented, Riley, that isn't it a bit of a joke that everybody believes that starting in the early 1970s, the productivity that business got out of labor went so high and the compensation was so far behind? Profits must be, they must be rolling in profits. Nobody looks at the implications of this. And of course, they're not rolling in profits. That's something else. Anyway, I hope I pointed this out cogently without having to show the chart. But I guess what, Tom, you're going to link to my talk, and there you can see the chart if you want to listen to my lecture at the Mises Institute.
So right. I want to make sure I understand why it's okay to use nominal dollars.
Okay.
It's, just make sure that it's methodologically legitimate for anybody who might be skeptical.
Yes.
So for instance, if I'm comparing how well does labor, quote unquote, do in, let's say, the 1960s compared to the 1970s, just looking at labor alone, then I might want to look at inflation adjusted because, you know, maybe in the 70s, maybe their wages went up 30%. Nominally, but if I adjust for inflation, I find out they're actually doing worse or something. I can see that. I'm comparing labor at one moment in history to labor at a moment in history farther in the future.
Yeah.
But if what I'm comparing are two things happening at exactly the same time, namely the measures of productivity and compensation at that exact moment, well, what difference does the inflation adjuster make? Because these things are happening at the same time. The issue with inflation is what happens over time. But if I'm looking at something that's simultaneous, why would I need to make that? Am I not getting it?
Absolutely, Tom. Yes, indeed. Look, you know, you've been one of my best popularizers, Tom, and I commend you on the way you put it. Absolutely. And of course, as I say, another way of putting it is in the actual real time, you know, real is they often use for inflation, business is dealing in nominal dollars. And indeed, nominal versus nominal, it equals a real relationship over time when you're lining these two things up in time. And then when you find that, then you say, well, what does it matter? You're inflation adjusting both sides of it, so you're keeping them together in that same way. But then when you find out that you're using two very different price measures for the two of them, and you find that it's all because of the price measures, then you have a problem. But getting back to the way you put it, Tom, absolutely. In other words, we want to concede that if you want to do something with how labor has been faring and you're dealing with aggregate numbers, you do need some kind of price index. And here, let me digress and put out my shocker to my Austrian friends. I believe that the CPI has been overstating price inflation, but that's another matter. But anyways, you put it very well, Tom. Again, if you want to find out how a single series is doing over time, then given the fact that there is price inflation, you want to use some kind of price index if it's some kind of aggregate series. But a price index can be dispensed with, and in terms of sort of Occam's razor, giving it the simplest message, you just line up with a nominal versus a nominal. And as a matter of fact, to anticipate, the point has been made with respect to labor share. Labor share is a nominal divided by a nominal. By the way, Damon Acemoglu, who's a professor at Harvard, he's made the point that we don't have to argue about price indexes when we take nominals versus nominals. It's a much more robust measure. And so, again, maybe I've anticipated a point, but you've summarized it very well. I'll give you an A+ on that, Tom. Yes.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, now let's talk about GDP, or let's say, quote unquote, national income,
yes,
and labor's overall share of national income, because that's also been a source of alarm for some people.
Well, it's been a bigger source, yeah, a major source of alarm. Yeah, yes, go ahead.
So how are we to understand this?
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned national income, I've always looked for, like, what is the best way for me to try to show that in this particular case, I'm the orthodox person. I'm the one who's going by the standard textbooks. I'm doing a mainstream measurement of the economy. I'm playing it strictly by the rules. And prestigious economists who've written about this, and I mean economists from Harvard and elsewhere who've actually published peer-reviewed articles on this, and I, by the way, along with this assistant chief economist at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, I'm going by the book. And so probably the best way to do it is because of what you've just said about national income. When I was asked at the Mises Institute, what do I have to recommend? I recommended my book, Econo-Spinning, a 2006 book, to learn about the numbers. And I recommended Bob Murphy's book on Contra-Krugman to learn about the numbers. But then when I was pushed, I realized, hey, look, the Bureau of Economic Analysis handbook, a 7-chapter handbook, is actually very well done. And if you want to play the game of the macroeconomic numbers, and Bob Murphy and I both play the game because we find that Paul Krugman can never get it right, then read that handbook. So then I quoted from the glossary of the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the definition of national income. And they define national income as after depreciation of capital, that the national income is what you have to go around after you've made an allowance for the depreciation, I should say, of capital goods. And so that's textbook. That's standard. I actually wrote a piece to a George Mason economist. I was applauded by this. I said, look, guys, this is the definition of national income. If you want to keep depreciation in this, why does national income get defined as the income after the allowance for depreciation? And depreciation, again, I quoted the handbook. Depreciation is the wear and tear on capital goods, the accidental damage, the obsolescence. And why, even if you just go back to a Caruso economy or any small economy, as you produce, your capital stock, your capital goods depreciate. And if you don't make a physical allowance to shore up that depreciated capital, then your capital goods will continue to depreciate year after year, and eventually you'll starve. You've got to keep shoring up capital for depreciation. And so that's the standard point. And that's the reason why You have to be wary when you deal with a measure like gross domestic product, because the mainstream also has a measure called net domestic product. Wary when you have a measure like gross domestic income, because the mainstream has a measure called net domestic income. Gross domestic income and gross domestic product are conceptually the same, although they come from different sets of data, but gross domestic income, gross domestic product include depreciation. Net figures, net domestic income and net domestic product make allowance for depreciation, just like national income does. And I hope I haven't bored the hell out of my listeners by belaboring that point, because I'm taking great pains to try to point out that I'm only teaching economics 101 and then shockingly trying to show that the mainstream has simply not read the textbook. So maybe you want to pick up, Tom, and popularize what I've just said, or do you want me to continue? Where do we go from here?
Well, I want you to go on, and then ultimately what I want to aim toward is asking you, is everything just in everybody's imagination? Why would people think, apart from the fact that they're making errors in the analysis, yes, is there any reason that they might look around and think labor seems to be getting screwed, or is it entirely in their imagination?
The reason why they think that labor is getting screwed is because they're measuring labor share being a ratio. You know, this is like basically maybe eighth grade arithmetic or seventh grade arithmetic. It's just a fraction. It's labor compensation as conventionally measured as a percentage of income output, something you put in the denominator. That's the numerator is labor compensation, and the denominator is some measure of output or measure of income, like, for example, national income. So once they take that percentage, and by the way, that's the reason why mainstream economists have said it's a great measure, because there too you don't have to use price indexes. You're taking a nominal in the numerator as a percentage of a nominal in the denominator. We're dealing only with nominal numbers. The reason they get a result that shows that labor share is in the pits is that they put gross measures in the denominator rather than net measures. And to anticipate your question, Tom, I believe that the reason why they're making that mistake is really twofold. In part, they really do have a zealous desire to draw conclusions about corporate greed and monopsony. You know, all these corporations and companies have been colluding together to make sure that wages stay low. They talk with each other on the phone all the time. You know, and they make sure, look, you know, Tom Woods just applied for a job with us, and he quit. Didn't he quit your company? Well, let's make sure that we stick together and offer him chump change. All these fantasies that they seem to love to embrace. And I think that's the reason why they have no curiosity to look further. They have no curiosity to read the textbooks and ask themselves, well, what would happen if we use the net figure in the denominator? They have no curiosity to ask themselves, what has actually happened to depreciation over the last number of decades? And that's the key to the problem. So it's a combination of sort of sloppiness and zealousness, this desire to constantly sort of be on the side of the left-wing angels, which leads them to make the simplest error imaginable, that you imagine they're scholars and they want to look under every nook and cranny, and all they need to do is read the paper written by this assistant chief economist of the Bureau of Economic Analysis, who points out that what has happened, and by the way, his paper is also about other countries. He points this out universally, that there's been a universal decision about labor share, because none of them are simply looking at the number that shows that depreciation has been taking an increasing bite out of the gross figure. That's an interesting story in itself, that depreciation has been doing this because of something that most of us probably intuit. In the period since World War II, about a 75-year period to the present, early in the 50s and 60s, there was a concentration on building structures for investment. Capital investment was focused a lot on building structures. And since the 70s, there's been an increasing concentration on equipment and software. And equipment and software depreciate much more quickly than structures do. And therefore, the interesting, like you might say, well, you know, we look at measures of GDP growth, but really we get a slightly different measure if we look at measures of NDP, net domestic product, because net domestic product has not been growing as fast because depreciation has been taking an increasing bite out of the situation. We've had to set aside more and more income in order to shore up the depreciation of that software and equipment than we had to do when the focus was on structures in the earlier period. That's the reason why you have to use net figures rather than gross. Do you want to take me to take this any further, Tom? You want to step in and popularize me?
No. I think that's as well explained as it can be. But I wonder if you can confirm that what may be happening here, yeah. It's hard to believe, yeah. Given that we know that our scholarly community is so disinterestedly pursuing the truth here, yeah. That, you know, without any competing interests, yeah. That a superficial look at the situation confirms the fashionable view that they all want to believe.
Yeah.
And in order to find out the truth, which is a very unfashionable conclusion, they have to dig further. Well, this is not really an incentive structure that's going to yield us the truth. You have to dig further to find an opinion that's going to make you unpopular. Who wants to do that?
Make you unpopular. Well... Yeah, you mean make you unpopular with the New York Times, you mean?
Yeah, with the New York Times, exactly right. Now, by the way, is it Benjamin Bridgman? Is that the name of the guy at the Bureau of Economic Analysis?
Yeah, no, indeed. I promoted his name. And actually, I don't know. You know, I hate to. He wrote me a very cordial note. I sent him a recent update and he's friendly. And he said, Gina, as usual, I completely agree with you. But what I don't get is, I wish he would go a little public. I mean, I don't think he's going to really listen to this podcast, so I don't want him to become offended by my remarks. But obviously, if I were an assistant chief economist at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, I would be talking to the press a little bit more. I would be using the weight of my authority a little bit more to correct this incredible swamp of mistakes. I mean, you know, the names I could mention, I guess, are not exactly household names, but they certainly come from household name universities that are drawing all kinds of conclusions about what's been going on. And so it's unfortunate that he has not stepped up to the plate and that's left to me to do so. It's even worse in another way that, for example, on Twitter, I corrected a New Yorker journalist about this. And he, I think he consulted with a couple of people, and he got back at me and he quoted a trend from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, this is the worst part of it, and that where Benjamin Bridgman would have to do battle with Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is at the Department of Labor, like it would be an intragovernmental dispute. The Bureau of Labor Statistics does not publish numbers on depreciation. Every time they do a labor share figure, they use the gross numbers. For example, they take a figure for the output, the gross value output of non-financial corporations. And as I explained in my talk, if you want to look at the corporate sector, it's better to take the trend on non-financial corporations because the numbers on financial corporations are different. Financial corporations were about 5% of the corporate sector. They're now up to about 13 to 14%. The whole rules there are different. So a core number is non-financial corporations. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics will issue a number. They don't take out depreciation. And so it's very easy to take Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers and show that labor share is in the pits. And this is exactly what the New Yorker writer did. And then, of course, what was I up against? I'm now going to question the numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. By the way, also, just to make it even more ridiculous, there is an article by a couple of economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics that appears in the Monthly Labor Review, where they basically concede that there is an argument for taking out depreciation, but they don't do so. And so I do want to get in touch with them. I've got other things on my plate, so I haven't had much time to go to Washington and maybe sit down with these guys and maybe try to enlist some support to get all these things changed. But anyway, I guess I'm answering your question, Tom.
Well, first of all, I want to say, I think the article you have in mind is called, Is Labor's Loss Capital's Gain, Gross Versus Net Labor Shares?
Well, that's Benjamin Bridgman's note.
The problem is that it's behind a subscription wall.
Oh, is it really?
So I just wanted people to know. Now, the thing is, you can find a working paper version from a little bit earlier that's a PDF under that title.
Yeah.
But I guess the other thing I want to ask you is, why does this matter? Apart from being an intellectual exercise and we always want to know the truth, what are the practical implications of people misunderstanding this? Like, what mistakes could they make because of this data?
Well, of course, conceptually, I know you had David Henderson on the show at least once, Tom.
Oh, yeah, a few times.
Yeah, and he's a great guy, very insightful.
Yes.
And I actually had him at a debate at the Thorne Forum. So dropping all kinds of names, I hope they're listening to this. David Henderson has written the Decline in the Labor Share of U.S. Income article, and he has written, he said, I told the students that while I'm no Marxist, I did find this a little concerning. Now, he has conceded the point. He's one of our allies, and he accepts the argument. He accepted the data. And so just, I guess, as a broad intellectual point, in an article I've tried to write on this, I've written a couple of pieces on it. I haven't really published very much about it, but I'm calling it the ghost of Karl Marx, that basically we're supposed to believe that, at least in terms of the past, labor was getting a certain share of income up till about 20 years ago, and then something happened. Karl Marx is haunting us. The corporations managed to shaft labor. So the left-wing narrative has become dominant. Breonna Joy Gray, who got a very popular podcast, she had Glenn Lowry on the show, and she's, of course, pushing a very extreme form of socialism, and she declared to Glenn Lowry, a very good economist at Brown University, labor has been getting less and less and less and less. So the argument for socialist reforms and for the progressive stepping in is just overwhelming. That's the danger on the horizon. And then, of course, Elizabeth Warren organized with a bunch of people. She quoted articles on the same subject. And so it's given rise to all kinds of campaigns. As a matter of fact, again, the Cato Institute had a paper on this where they conceded the point, and they said, well, we've got to push for more labor representation on corporate boards. We've got to get the iron fist of government involved, because after all, look at what has happened to American capitalism. Now, with that said, I can't claim that what's recently happened from the Biden administration has been motivated by this broad-scale myth. But I can only say, watch out, because it's been so accepted into the canon that it could easily give rise to, again, I'm not against workers getting on corporate boards. I've gone on record saying, look, if workers want to own companies, I applaud that. I just don't want it imposed from the top. I don't want the iron fist of government to impose this, because that way lies all kinds of catastrophes that won't get us anywhere. But I have to say that we've got to get our facts straight, so that we can make sure that at least a reasonable number of the mainstream economists recognize that this whole thing is a fraud. So I guess that's the best answer I can give. I can't claim that the house is on fire yet, but I can say that there's a danger that it could become so. Benjamin Friedman, he's an economist at Harvard University. He published a long article on worker ownership in the New York Review of Books, and he made the same point. Labor share has declined, it's getting shafted, and therefore there's a big argument for worker ownership. Once again, I hasten to say that if workers want to own companies, I can tell them how to do that. It's perfectly doable. It's if they want to do it voluntarily, I would actually welcome it. I just don't want it imposed by the iron fist of government, and that's pretty much the way the wind is blowing. That's why I'm concerned.
It seems as if it would be a good idea for you somehow to write this up as a paper and present it somewhere, you know, or even get it published in a journal. I mean, not that that's going to reach the average person, but yeah, it'd be good for this, for it to be not just poor Benjamin Bridgman holding everything up, right?
Oh, I see. Oh, I like that. Poor Gene Epstein. He's doing poor Benjamin Bridgman. He's got a nice job.
Yeah. Gene Epstein should write a peer-reviewed, uncompensated, because nobody gets paid to write a journal article. You should do this uncompensated work for us, Gene.
Exactly.
I don't know. We need to get this. I mean, I guess to me, the key thing is just the idea that labor share is declining leads to, quote, we need to do something.
Yeah.
Which leads to, we can't sit back and do nothing, which leads to, the free market can't be trusted to provide for the welfare of the most vulnerable, which leads to all kinds of fallacies once we start down this road. That's why we have to fix it.
Precisely, Tom. Thanks for mentioning that. And of course, you know, pathetically, instead of my delivering this paper before the American Economic Association, I got to deliver it at Porkfest and at the Mises Institute. You know, that's so I have a few acolytes out there.
I love that you took a topic this technical and brought it to Porkfest. Okay. I mean, that is a Gene Epstein move right there.
Yeah. And well, you know, it was a classroom. No, look, I do you know that when I delivered this, I was competing with Scott Horton. He was at the big pavilion. Scott was apologetic about that. You know why? This is funny. We all blamed it on Utah. Scott, being light-footed, he had to fly down on Friday night to go to your wedding.
Right.
And so Scott was going to deliver his major talk on a Saturday, but had to bunch it up. And I said, Scott, we're competing. He said, oh, God, Gene, I'm so sorry. Got to go to Tomlin's wedding. But still, I was heartened to notice that I had a practically full house, about 40 people showed up to my classroom. I was enough of a draw.
That's actually a great turnout for a topic like that.
Yeah, great turnout, particularly when you're competing with Scott Horton.
And if it's a Thursday, I mean, some people, you know, it really, really gets cooking on Friday.
By Thursday, they were right.
A lot of people? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
A few people. Yeah, no, it reaches critical mass by Thursday. But, well, we're talking about Porkfest. I think, Porkfest is a great event, but the crazy thing is, you know, at Porkfest, there's so many interesting things going on, and they can't even keep up with it informationally. There's just only the formal talks are listed, rather than all the informal enclaves everywhere when interesting things happen. Anyway, we're talking about Porkfest. But back to my problem. My problem is that I've been a keynote speaker at Porkfest and at the Mises Institute, but you have to take the show on the road and see if you can alert other people. Probably, Tom, what I should do is meet with the guys at the Bureau of Labor Statistics who've written an article saying that depreciation really should be incorporated. It's a good argument for it. Meet with Benjamin Bridgman and ask him, you know, look, you're the guy. Why don't you update the paper? By the way, we've been dwelling on this, Tom, but I really want to focus as well on an important conceptual point because it is vital to the analysis. Every measure that I put up of labor share, when Benjamin Bridgman says that labor share is within its historical range, he's talking about the period since World War II. The quarterly numbers are 1947 to the present. Now, again, you could go back to the Great Depression, you go back to World War II. I think it's fairly intuitively obvious that those were very odd periods, very different periods. And so taking the period since the late 1940s is certainly a good chunk of history. Now, what does every trend show with respect to labor share? Properly measured, that is, where the net figures are there. Net figures in the denominator rather than gross figures. It does show that over the last 20 years, we're doing a bit better than we were in the 1950s and 60s. It's a higher share. It does show, however, that labor share started to rise in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And since then, there was a 30-year period when labor share was higher, and then it came down in the last 20 years. So if you get the general picture, it's 50s and 60s, and then it rises, and then it goes back and stays a little bit higher than it was in 50s and 60s. Now, that trend alone turns the world upside down for the progressives. If we are doing better than we did in the 50s and 60s, then how can any of their explanations for labor share trends hold up? Unionization, private sector unionization, was one-third of the private sector, give or take, in the 50s and 60s. It's now down to 6%. So if they're going to blame it on labor unions, why are we doing better than we were in the 1950s and 60s? If they're going to blame it on competition from abroad, from cheap labor abroad, how come we're doing better? There was no cheap labor from abroad competing in the 50s and 60s. If these mainstream economists from Harvard are going to blame it on the superstar firms, how does that work? There were no superstar firms like Google and Amazon in the 50s and 60s. So their explanations do not hold up. By the way, I should also say I've had some very friendly exchange. I won't mention him because maybe he'll get in trouble with his employer. There is a journalist at the New York Times who's written me some very friendly and respectful emails and was interested when I challenged what he wrote. He accepted it. He tried to make some arguments. I wrote him back patiently. He began to concede the point. I am, by the way, I'm debating a New York Times, another guy, New York Times editorial writer in October, Benjamin Applebaum, and I'm going to make this point to him a bit as well. But I digress a little bit. My only point is that if you want to say, and I wrote this to this New York Times journalist, if you want to take the trend from 1970 to the present, then you do show a decline. And in matter of fact, one of his colleagues at the New York Times limited it to 1970, clearly cut it off because it was embarrassing if you look back to the 50s and 60s. She'd put national income into the denominator, and then she recognized this didn't look good, so she took it from 1970 to the present. But if you follow me here, what I'm saying is that why do you cut it off at 1970? Look, you can do that if you want to, but then the obvious question arises, if you're giving all the explanations, including unionization, competition from abroad, superstar firms, productivity, all of these explanations, then you have to ask yourself, well, the obvious question, what about a period when none of these factors were present? Then, logically, you want to look at the 50s and 60s. And so I think he accepted my point, because that's where he was flailing a little bit. He said, hey, look, you know, the 50-year trend is down. I said, isn't that a little bit dishonest to ignore the 50s and 60s when the progressives are saying those were the glory days? So hopefully I've dealt with that nuanced point. But by the way, I did not point out at the Mises Institute a couple of very egregious trends that libertarians have been pointing to could be the reason why we've declined from the 80s and 90s, because of the two factors that have begun to bite, making it more difficult for laborers at the lower end to get decent jobs that are limited in their mobility. That's the rise of restrictive licensure. 5% of jobs had restrictive licensure about 50 years ago, and now it's up to 25%. And then the rise of the intervention into the housing markets that started in the late 1960s that made it more and more difficult for labor to move to high-wage areas. Ed Glaser at Harvard has been very good on this. So we do find ways in which a wage inequality has been exacerbated by government policies, mainly, of course, local government policies, to make it more and more difficult to build, which started in the late 1960s. That may be a reason why labor share is hurting a little bit. But of course, that's the fault of government. But again, the broad brushstrokes are that we're doing at least as well or better than we were in the 1950s and 60s. And then in the 70s and 80s and 90s, when all those awful things happened, Reagan came on the scene, broke the back of the unions, and labor share is doing better. So all of these trends basically make a hash and nonsense out of the explanations put forward by the mainstream and the explanations put forward by the progressives. So hopefully I've dealt with that nuance, Tom. Maybe you want to popularize a little bit to make it a little bit clearer. I hope I haven't lost people in the explanation that I've just put forward.
No. But at the same time, I don't want to leave the impression that I always need to translate for the great Gene Epstein. Okay. I will simply say people should check out, even if you don't live in New York City, check out thesohoforum.org, because when Gene debates, or when anybody at the Soho Forum debates, you can attend it through the live stream, and you can also get the recording. They have a podcast where they have all the previous Soho Forum debates.
Yeah.
I was listening to the one about, had to do with prescription drugs, and was that leading to addiction, like pain medication, stuff like that. And I remember thinking, well, gee, both sides seem to have a real command of the data. I can't quite figure this out. How could they both? And that ended up being a tie, I think, which must be very rare.
No, absolutely. Yeah, we had one other absolute tie down to the decimal point. I will say, Tom, that one of my frustrations has been that I thought my Soho Forum debates could be a springboard for me to draw lessons out of each debate. But then it became necessary, logically, for me to potentially find fault with one or the other debater. And I was counseled wisely, I guess, that if I make a habit out of getting people into these stressful situations and debating, and then they find that they're getting criticized afterwards in public, that this is going to be a problem. So I have to keep mute most of the time. If I have a criticism of a debater, I generally meet with them privately afterwards to tell them where I thought they went right or went wrong. I have to keep this to myself mostly. So I was a little critical about how it went, but indeed that one was a dead heat. And I'm trying to remember, we had one other where there was a dead heat. Amazingly, usually, of course, we find that there is a winner. And usually I find that I tend to agree with the vote of the Soho Forum about who won. By the way, I've tried to clarify. I had a good question from the audience, and we've been talking about the Soho Forum. Good question was, well, are you supposed to sort of grade the debaters or grade how you felt? In other words, grade the debaters on how they did when you vote, or are you supposed to grade how you felt about the issue after the debate, you know, versus before the debate. And I said, of course, I prefer the latter. How did either debater change your mind in any way, move you in one direction or another? And by the way, I have told Bob Murphy that when the one debate where I thought George Selgin, when he debated Bob Murphy on fractional reserve banking, was making some interesting points that I hadn't heard before, an interesting clash on fractional reserve banking versus 100%, which I know, of course, is a very, you know, sort of parochial argument between libertarians. But I thought Selgin was making some interesting points that, and they are, at least I went public with it, although Bob put up a good fight about that one. But anyway, you mentioned my debates. Again, we're having a debate on September 19th, our sixth anniversary. And then in October, I forget the exact date, but look it up at thesoilforum.org. I will be debating a rare opportunity to have a debate with the editorial writer at the New York Times who writes about economics. And so this will be an interesting clash. And of course, certainly, as you probably know, Tom, it's often difficult to get people of that type to come into the arena at the Soul Forum. And I certainly am very thankful to this guy to be willing to come and debate me.
All right, Gene, thanks so much for your time. I'm going to link to the books that you recommended and to your talk at tomwoods.com/2193. Looking forward to seeing you next month.
Thanks a lot, Tom, and see you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that'll do it for today. Now, tomorrow we got our old friend Eric Peters coming back onto the show. And I know some of you say, well, I'm not interested in cars, so I just let those episodes pass. Oh, that's a mistake. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, well, I'm not interested in cars either, but I am interested in listening to Eric Peters because he has such important stuff to say. And as he says to me in tomorrow's episode, look, he says, you may not be a car guy, but this is about a lot more than cars. It's about mobility. And if you can't move around, well, what kind of life is that? And they are throwing all kinds of obstacles in the path of ordinary people moving around. We just heard about what's going on in California, where they're going to ban the sale of new gas-powered cars by 2035. And you think, wow, maybe all is lost. But Eric Peters has a sense that all is not necessarily lost. So you're going to want to tune in tomorrow. And if you like and appreciate the old Tom Woods show, then check out supportinglisteners.com. Gene Epstein is a member of my private group because all the smart people are. And you can chit-chat with Gene even in the Tom Woods show elite. And that is only one of the many benefits I am glad to bestow on those good souls who help me out. So check out supportinglisteners.com and see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.